Kia ora and welcome to Sobriety Chat. I am your host, Lotta Dan, otherwise known as Mrs. D. I am the community manager and content creator here at Living Sober. And today I'm joined by my very good friend, who I've known for many years, Guyan Espada. Now, Guyan is many things. He's a journalist, he's an author, he's a broadcaster, he's a dad. I think he's a keen runner still. Bit of a musician, and he is sober. Welcome, Guyan. How are you? Can you hear me?
Thank you very much. Yes, just slightly cutting out there, but I think we've got you.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Guyan. So I said in the intro, I don't know if you heard me, but we're old mates.
Yep.
And let's be honest, we've been drinking a few times together, and sometimes I think, gosh, if we could go back in time and talk to ourselves when we were, you know, having fun drinking and say, in the future, you're going to be bonding over being sober, how we might have felt about that. Can you think back to, you know, those times that we spent together and how times have changed?
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember them very well, including your wedding and many other great occasions. And yeah, look, a lot of them were fun. And I think, you know, you've got to acknowledge that. I do, in my own approach to this, acknowledge that I had a lot of great times on alcohol. I guess for a lot of us, isn't it, it's about when the dark times or the negatives outweigh the positives, and it took me a long time to realize that that was happening for me. And I think too, to be honest with ourselves, and Paddy Gower may have seen something like this too, that age does change things to some degree. You know, so I think it is more likely that you're going to take in a kind of approach that possibly we've taken after some years have gone by. That's not to say anything about younger people who want to go down this path at all, I think that there is something in that, whether it's just hopefully it's wisdom, possibly it's the accumulation of experiences is over that time. But yeah, I don't know, to answer your question, I would have been very surprised to be revealed that we would be bonding over this. But, you know, all power to you and the influence that you've had on me. And, you know, yeah. I'm glad to be part of that club.
Yeah, oh, it's a great club. It's interesting what you say about age because, yeah, I mean, it's probably fair to say a lot of our members are 40s, 50s and beyond, and every now and then we have someone join our community who's in their 20s or 30s, and everyone's always saying, oh, I wish I'd done it earlier. But it is rare to have people in those younger decades come through. So, yeah, I agree with you. It seems to be something, it takes us a while to kind of admit the truth, I suppose, that it's not really serving us, this drug.
Yes, I think that's very true. And my own experience was exactly that. I mean, I would have literally had hundreds of mitigation strategies, all of which failed. You know, oh, I'm only going to stick to beer. Oh, I'll drink low alcohol beer until 10 o'clock at night, and then I'm going to cut into the beers. Red wine's my problem. Red wine's my saviour. Whatever it was. Let's download this app because it counts the drinks. It's going to be fine. None of it worked. And it took me an embarrassingly long time. I mean, I think I was 47 or something like that. It was 2019, it's about 6 years ago. So it took me an embarrassingly long time, you know, to realise that. And I do think of the shameful amount of wasted money, wasted time. I mean, if only, you know, I mean, that's one of the things that you can talk to people about, isn't it? Like, you know, okay, let's say you can manage your drinking relatively well, and you know, the first three or four drinks are fine, but the 11 that you had after that is just so much wastage in terms of brain cells, money, time, the impediments and challenges that you put in your way. So yeah, I'm thankful that I finally woke up, but man, it took me a long time.
Yeah, I mean, some people never do it, let's be honest. So, you know, you could, you know, think if only sooner, but hey, we did it and here we are. And I don't know. I mean, oh, it's complicated, isn't it? I just want to ask you, in those years where you were trying every mitigation strategy, as you say, I'm always really interested in the inner dialogue, because my inner dialogue, I can almost pinpoint to the day where the little worried voice started piping up. Is this normal? I'm hungover again. Is this normal? I'm full of guilt. I can, and that inner dialogue, that back and forth that went on for me for about 4 years before I quit. Did you have that through the time of you trying to control, or were you just like, I just need to learn, you know, talk to me about that inner dialogue and that worried voice that you had.
Yeah, well, my worried voice started pretty early on, because at the age of about 20, 21, I spent the night in a prison cell after an altercation with the police in Christchurch, after drinking a bottle and a half of vodka, an amount that would just about, you know, kill someone. You could die on it, and then drank it fairly quickly. And then, so that was my preload. Then I went out into town and got banned for life from Warners, which got taken down in the Christchurch earthquakes. And so I'm presumably not banned for that anymore. Got into some altercation with the cops and spent the night in prison. My dad and my brother came and picked me up the next day. That evening, it was a Saturday, it was a Friday that got into the trouble. Went along to a barbecue and took a 6-pack of beer, because that was a light night, and so I thought I was being responsible. So look, any reasonable sane person would have realized that I was potentially having an issue there. I felt failure. I'd somehow let myself down. Next time I would stop earlier, you know, and then you go back to the mitigation strategies we talked about. That was an exceptional circumstance, but it was a very early warning. And, you know, probably every 6 weeks to 2 months after that, for years, I would have blackouts, times that I couldn't remember what had happened. I never did anything that was, you know, egregiously bad or violent or anything like that. Probably got into a couple of fights along the way, but, you know, nothing that I was shameful of. But certainly all of those signals were there. But the way I took those on board was, I'm a failure. As a man, I should be able to drink more and handle it. You handle your piss, mate.
Right.
Was all the time, and I was right. Like so. I was, and to me, as a child of the 70s, I'm a Gen Xer born in 70, people just wanting the reference points, you know, it was a measure of how, you know, your mana or your, you know, your standing to some degree. And so I felt that I was a failure. And giving, just remember, Lotta, giving up was not an option in my head at that point. And in the 80s, it just wasn't an option. You literally were. So we were starting drinking about 14, so about 84, 85. We didn't know anyone who didn't drink alcohol. If you didn't, you had a serious, like, you were ostracized. And part of why we didn't know anyone who didn't drink alcohol, probably because they just wouldn't have had a social life. So yeah, it's bad enough nowadays, but in the mid-80s in New Zealand, and then, you know, we were off to university and things, and that was all so much a part of the culture. The idea, you know, it would literally have been, it was living. It was literally on a par with going to prison, you know, if you ask someone to give up alcohol. So that wasn't an option in my head. That wasn't an option. So I just had to find ways to try to mitigate it, you know. So that was my thing.
I mean, and it's so true. And I mean, now we sobriety and not drinking is becoming much more normalized, and it's an option that's in people's minds as something that they could do. But for me as well, there weren't that many kind of role models of people who were sober. And I often say, this is tragic but true, but it was random celebrities that I'd seen on the red carpet on Channel E, like Keith Urban and Rob Lowe, who I knew were sober, and it was seeing them that was quite key for me, because I knew that they'd stopped drinking and they didn't look miserable. And that was the first kind of this is an option thought for me. But turning that onto myself, I mean, who doesn't drink? It's a terrifying process. So what happened that you finally were able to go, this is something I could do, and how did that feel? the possibility.
It's it's interesting because it ended with a whimper rather than a bang. To misquote T.S. Eliot, it was just one Sunday morning, mid 2019, and I don't even record the date because I knew then that was for the rest of my life, so I didn't want to say, oh, you know, it's the 17th of July or whatever. I just went, nah, that's it, which was a weird decision given I'd spent so long and it'd been such a massive part of my life. It was a Sunday morning. We'd had a dinner party the night before. I drank too much wine and couldn't remember exactly what had happened. It wasn't anything dramatic, but it was just one of hundreds of occasions in my life, and I just weirdly said to myself, that's it, mate, you've had your chance, you can't do this anymore. And I just immediately on that Sunday morning just went, nah, that's it. And I haven't drunk a drop of alcohol since. I didn't go to any counseling sessions or AA or anything like that, and that's, you know, I think all of these people do fantastic work, so there's nothing but nothing to be proud of. I mean, as I say, I should have picked up those warnings 25 years earlier. So there's nothing to skite about there at all. I found it, the other little thing for people to know is that for me, I'm a type 1 diabetic, and about a year earlier than that, I had been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, so I'm an insulin-dependent diabetic, and I had cut sugar entirely out of my diet. Now, you've researched this topic a lot too, so you'll know a little bit about this, but I don't eat almost any carbohydrate. And this was a massive change for me. That means eating no processed food, nothing in a packet, nothing from, you know, all my favorite foods and stuff. And I actually switched to low carb beer as well and wine at that time. So I carried on drinking. But at that point on that Sunday morning when I was making that call, I knew in my head that I could cut and ditch alcohol and leave it behind because I'd done that with sugar. So I felt some empowerment for that. I mean, I should have also just given it up because of the dangers as a type 1. It's not a great thing to do to get really drunk as a type 1 diabetic because, yeah, you can you don't get the signals from your body that you're going into hypoglycemia, which is low blood sugar, yeah, etc. So you can get into real trouble. But that hadn't worried me for the last year. But I mean, I think that gave me some knowledge that I had the power to give something that had been so core to my life away. But again, that's probably retrospective psychobabble in some ways.
It makes perfect sense. You were really focusing on your system, what was going in, what was happening. The alcohol was a part of that, putting it in your body. But I think also all of that, years of those mitigation strategies, as you put it, would have also, you know, we talk about the stages of change, the wheel of change. It's a long process. And there would have been work going on in the back brain around just all that work, thinking about your habit, all the things just combined on that Sunday morning when you made that decision. But tell me, were you nervous? Were you excited? What did you think it would be like?
I knew that I was going to keep that decision. I'm pretty stubborn when I put my mind to it. And it's weird, isn't it, that, you know, for so long you've been thinking something so massive and then suddenly you've just gone, nah, I'm finished. So I knew I was going to stick to it. I was surprised, very surprised at how little I missed it. Like, I loved it's not only that I love the feeling of being drunk, because it's, you know, it's all their fuzzies and all that. I loved beer. I loved the taste of it, you know. I always loved beer and red wine. I didn't miss it at all. I didn't miss it at all. And I never have. And I've never been tempted to even have a drop. I've got a bottle of red wine on the counter at home, on the table at home, because someone came around for a drink the other night and had some wine. I mainly live alone. I have my daughter every second week, but I'm there on my own. I've never once been tempted to drink alcohol. As I've said to others in fora, we've talked about this, the biggest issue for me, and this was a surprise too, was how much other people would take exception to my decision. I found it quite extraordinary, and still do, that people take issue with the fact that you don't drink. And that can be subtle or not so subtle. I mean, I was literally, someone very, very forcibly in a kind of family, wider family situation, tried to pretty much forced me to drink this Pinot Gris that they had, like saying, oh, well, I know you don't drink alcohol, but you have to try this particular Pinot Gris.
You just went on and on.
But even my own dad, who I love so much, said, you know, you don't drink, but do you want to have a beer? I mean, I suppose it was just habit. And it's hard for other people, because if you've been quite a big drinker, and I was, people still think it's the old you, and they, and with people like yourself doing the work and more public, people need to be a bit more aware of that sort of stuff. It isn't cool to try to force people to drink, you know, it really isn't. But it wasn't even so much, it was at the extreme, but even at the less extreme, I still get people saying, hey, we should catch up for a beer. Oh, you don't drink, do you? As though that's the end of it. We can't go out.
No catch up.
We can't catch up. There's no catch up. It ain't going to happen.
Yeah. That's so crazy. I've always been very interested in you talking about this, and I've heard you talk about it, and I've read your book, which is a great book, by the way. I'll put the link in the description. But I didn't get that going. I just haven't. Yeah. I can count on one hand the number of times someone's hassled me or pressured me or awkwardly said any of those things, like you've just said, oh, we should have a wine. Oh, no, that's right. You don't, like, I just didn't get that. So I don't know why that is, because you've always been pretty open as well about, I don't drink anymore because I can't control it. Were you saying that, or were you more sort of a blessed? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, no. People,
because you're a man? I don't know.
It could, I mean, there are a couple of options, aren't there? I might have been more visible with my drinking, so people might have expected me to continue that. It may be a gender thing to some degree. It may be the just the circles moving in or whatever. I'm not sure, but I have encountered a lot of it. Less so now, but some pretty, I found, extreme and quite blatant examples, where everyone in the group would turn to you and wait your answer. And look, it's possible to be fair to people that I took it more seriously. But it was pretty, it's pretty awful. Like, you'd walk into a party. Yeah. You know, I still remember these occasions, and you come back with a water because no one was serving anything else. And then people would be unpicking your decision for 5 minutes. It's pretty uncomfortable. It's pretty bad.
And it definitely does still exist in some pockets. Yeah. I know some of our members often talk about this is quite a big factor for them in quitting, is the pressure they get. So it is a real thing.
Mm. Just last week or a couple of weeks ago, I went out with someone who doesn't drink either, and I ordered, she wanted a ginger beer and I was having a Diet Coke, and I went up to the bar and ordered these drinks, and the guy said, do you want alcohol with either of those drinks? it's still a factor for people.
It's still a factor, and that speaks to our society. But hey, how do you go at parties now? Now, I saw you at a party recently. We were at my husband's 50th down at the Cashmere Club in Christchurch, and you and I had a lovely chat late in the evening, which I so appreciated, because it's the time of evening often where the chats are, repetitive or smelly. But how do you go walking into social events like that now and knowing it's a boozy affair? And, you know, I know how I feel, but how is it for you being in those environments of parties and the like and being sober?
Look, it's really pretty good. You know, I think for people listening to this who are embarking on that journey too, it is difficult in the beginning, and you're not quite sure how you're going to react if you feel confronted or you're put in an uncomfortable position. And I think you just need to work out a few things about how you're going to approach it, what your strategy is going to be, even the practical things like what drinks you are going to bring and how you're going to manage yourself in that way. So there's some practical logistical stuff. What's my line going to be? What am I going to say? Is there a joke I can use? Am I going to go for the zero alcohol beers or whatever it is? I don't do those, but some people do, and great. Or your Cokes or whatever you're going to go for. So there's the practical logistical stuff that you need to have sorted out. But look, I've found that, for myself, fantastic. There's a few exceptions when when there are events that get really, really liquid really quickly, I think, you know, I don't mind the long, slow, you know, and people are a little bit squiffy by the end of the night, and that's fine. It's when you're at a one where it's all about the drinking.
Yeah.
And I was at one of those, it was a wee while ago now, but, you know, and with people in their 40s and 50s, and but they just got so drunk so quickly, and then you've got someone telling you the same story four times, and you just can't, you just literally just get me out of here. I just can't handle that. But that's pretty rare now. I mean, or I'll just shuffle away from someone who's obviously just well gone, you know. But I love my going out. I love my social stuff. I probably am more social. I certainly go out to far more gigs than I ever used to, and love the music. I love going out to dinner where you actually can taste and concentrate on the food, you know, because everything had alcohol. And I remember even going to kids' movies with my daughter and having two or three craft beers, you know, just totally unnecessary. I love the social aspect, and I love talking, as you can see. I mean, I love that, and I'm keen to go to those events. And I don't need booze at all. I wouldn't dream of it. That's the other thing. Just to flash back to something you said before, I mean, in terms of how I've approached it, to me now, and I hope this doesn't sound hyperbole, but alcohol to me feels like a poison. I just wouldn't put it in my body. I just don't think about it. It's just like, oh no, I just wouldn't do it. So it's a weird mindset. I don't know. I'd be fascinated to know how my brain works, because I really wish I could have captured that a lot earlier. But
I can totally relate. And when you were talking about the red wine on your table and how you have no pull towards it, I mean, I look at that, I literally just think it's poison in a fancy bottle. I think other people can have that shit. I just, it has no pull for me now. I look at it as a toxin, and I get
so
it. It works. Yeah. You know, it does what it says on the bottle. It gives you the immediate lift, but I've learned how to not need that anymore and just be in the raw. And I try really hard not judge other people for drinking, because, you know, I get it. Not everyone struggles with alcohol, but I honestly just look at it like we're just in this matrix of crazy where it's sold as this magical elixir, and it's the opposite. And obviously that's why I still do what I do, because I want to help people. Guy, and there are so many people struggling. They just keep coming into our community, and they keep coming in, and they're quiet, and they're feeling diminished, and they're feeling alone, and they're feeling stuck, and they've got that fear of what happens if I quit. And there's so many people, and it just infuriates me that this drug's been allowed to be positioned so comfortably in the middle of everything. And so I'm really grateful you're in this space as well, speaking honestly and openly about your journey, because all our journeys are different, but there's always little bits that people can take.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's interesting to hear what you said about celebrities and who didn't drink, because you do need role models in any you know, when I got diagnosed with type 1, I was on Google, like, who's got type 1? Oh, there's this cricketer. Oh, there's this marathon runner. Oh, there's this musician. Of course, because you're trying to say, what's open to me? You know, who are some people who have done well despite, you know, having a condition or not drinking or whatever? So it's really important that people get out there and talk about how you can have a great life without alcohol. That's what I'd like to see more of. You know, I really think you need those sort of campaigns. You know, we all know the carnage that it can create. I think what's less celebrated is the joy and how you can live a fantastic life without alcohol, like to be positive about it rather than censorious about the people who do. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in saying, you know, you can have a fantastic life. You don't need this drug. It's just going to hold you back. It's going to waste a shitload of your time. I mean, one of the biggest things I've noticed too is how easy a lot of the stuff is that I do. Like, I'm a journalist. I do live interviews. I just interviewed the China's ambassador today. That could have been quite a stressful thing. With, you know, you need a lot of knowledge and agility to do that. I used to do just about all of those interviews hungover. Yeah, because back in my big drinking days at TVNZ, you know, most of the you're on breakfast TV and stuff, or you know, be a big day. The next day, budget day was a Thursday, but you'd gone out Wednesday night. You know, you'd arrive in the office and you'd be hungover most of the day. You couldn't wait to get to the pub at six after you'd done your live cross. I mean, I just did it and I survived it, and I still did relatively well. But Jesus, those things are so much easier to do without booze ever being an option. I mean, I'm a runner too. You know, used to struggle through. Oh, you know, this has affected my training, but I can still do it. It's basically like putting a 40 kilogram pack on your back, you know, and trying to struggle through life and wade through the treacle. You're just so much more onto it without booze. It's just such a crap. I mean, it's just such a sloppy drug too. I mean, that's the thing. I get it that people need, and cultures always have in through the millennia, used various substances to take the prefrontal cortex offline or to de-stress or whatever. The problem for us is that we've picked the most dangerous one, and we've almost given it a monopoly and almost a compulsory position. And it's just such a sloppy, unforgiving bastard of a drug. And that's the problem you've got. And you're pitching it to people as though it's just a good time and it's just this facilitation. You call it a social lubricant, yeah. But it's also, you know, potentially cancerous, causing it weight gaining, shame bringing thing. So it's unfortunately just quite a clumsy one that we've picked. To give that position of almost a compulsory drug, and it's the only one you're allowed to legally have.
Yeah, and it's so true what you say about social lubricant. And, you know, before we close, I just want to hark back to what I said at the start, which you and I spent many times together connecting. And in those early days when we were connecting with alcohol, it's not the same. We think it's a social lubricant. We think it connects us, but it disconnects. And like you were saying, talk to someone drunk at a party, you just want to get away from them. It's not a connector. Yeah. It does the opposite. No. And now that I'm sober, now you're sober, we have these meaningful, great connections.
That's right, and it's raw, and that's what people need to realise, you know, because you don't have, and if you're meeting someone new or you're having difficult conversations, it will be raw, but you will remember it all. It'll be authentic, it'll be genuine, and it'll be the real you. It's not you hiding behind, you know, seven stubbies of whatever. It's you in your real self. And if there are issues with that, then maybe you need to work on those, or, you know, and you can. So I think you're right that while you think it's this big connection, often, you know, those sort of drinking buddies that we had, you know, you can't remember exactly what was said. There's a bit of shame here, and then you just get into it again. They aren't often deep, genuine connections of the type that you have when, you know, when alcohol's not involved.
You are a gift. Thank you, my dear friend. And I can't believe you interviewed the Chinese ambassador today and made time for little old living sober
talking
about your sobriety. I really appreciate your time, Dion, and I know the members are going to really enjoy hearing you.
Well, that's awesome. And I would always make time for this. It's such an important kaupapa. The work that you've done is extraordinary. You've been absolute leading light on this, and I just think it's really important. And again, my main message is you can have a great life without booze.
Mic drop. Thank you.
Awesome. Kia ora. All right. Hey, great to talk. Okay. Cheers.
Bye.